Welcome to the Alberta Mentoring Partnership Mentoring Minute podcast. In today's episode, we are joined by Liz O'Neill, who among other roles is a co-chair of the Alberta Mentoring Partnership and executive director of Boys and Girls Club's Big Brothers Big Sisters of Edmonton and area. Many of our listeners know Liz and have likely crossed paths with her along her journey. But for those of you who are new executive directors, new in your role in a mentoring organization, or new to the mentoring movement, this interview will have many gems for you to consider and reflect on in your work. We talk about fundraising, politics, fund development, dealing with failure, and building a good team. So welcome to Liz, and congratulations again on hitting the big 40 milestone with your agency.
Thanks, Michael, very much, and thanks for including me today.
Yes, well, let's begin at the beginning. How did you get involved in the mentoring movement in Alberta?
I applied for a job at what was then known as Big Sisters of Edmonton. And I had moved here from the East. I accepted that position, and that began a journey that has now lasted 40 years.
And looking back beyond your agency, you were also involved in the very beginning of the Alberta Mentoring Partnership. So could you tell us a little bit about why it was important to build a partnership around the concept of mentoring?
Absolutely, Michael. You know, research began to come out of the United States around 1995 on some major studies that had been done on mentoring, and really showed the difference that caring adults could have in kids' lives. And it made sense that if we were going to create a place and a space in Alberta for more citizens to step up and be part of that network of people for our kids, that if we did it together, we would probably get a lot further than if we did it agency by agency by agency. And some of us had the privilege of attending a summit in Toronto in 2001 and met some people from the U.S. Who were talking about some of the work that they had been doing, came home and immediately found support here from the government of Alberta and from the Matard Foundation, as well as a number of youth serving agencies across the province. Came together, took us a few years to sort through what that would look like and what was possible, but we certainly have now been at it for 18 years. With official support and funding from the government of Alberta for nearly the last 11 years, which is, I think, a pretty major statement about our province and about its pioneering type of attitude. Roll up your sleeves, there's a job to get done, and how government and community could come together to do that together.
In addition to the support of government that has been crucial, you've often spoke about how the mentoring movement in Alberta wouldn't exist without thousands of caring volunteers. And looking back, I was wondering if you could share an observation about what have you noticed over the last 40 years about the changing nature of volunteerism in Alberta?
Do you know, it's interesting. If you ask somebody why they're not involved, they'll say because no one asked them. And it's a lot harder today to ask because we have so many fragmented distribution systems. I can remember 40 years ago, we might have had 3 radio stations in Edmonton. I think we have 12 today. And if you think about all the ways we now communicate, I think it's a lot harder to get closer to the citizen to let them know that they are needed. But I also think that volunteerism has had some changes in it as we've kind of grown up. People are busy. Life is hard. People are balancing so many things with school and loans to go to school and jobs and part-time jobs and full-time jobs and jobs that are away from home that you have to travel to, and trying to be the very, very best that you can be for your own family, whether that's your mom or your dad or your own brothers or sisters or your nieces or nephews. So life's a lot more complicated, I think, today than certainly when I began to grow up. Or at least we notice it to be more complicated today. I think that if my mom was answering this question, she might say, no, you just didn't know how complicated it was. But that aside, I think that things move at a rate that is different now. But I think that the number one challenge is really being able to get close to citizens, to be able to let them know that they are needed. Because what we certainly hear from people is that when we tell them that they're needed, people are most likely to put up their hand and say, oh, then how can I be helpful?
And one of the ways we're trying to address this is through different models. And we've seen success across Alberta through youth workplace mentoring, like corporate mentoring programs. We've seen volunteering increasing through school-based mentoring programs. So wearing your executive director hat, where are your best bets in terms of youth mentoring if we're going to close the mentoring gap across Alberta?
Do you know, Michael, that's such an important question. And I think, first of all, we need to build out a movement of young leaders, particularly our high school students, who can look out for our junior high kids and look out for our elementary kids and help transition them through some of the things that they themselves will have just in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years themselves been through, like transitioning from junior high to high school, which can be a pretty scary time for kids. But I think that in this province, we have hundreds of thousands of young people that if we could mobilize them into a youth service corps kind of concept, I think that there'd be a fantastic future there. I also think the concept of corporate mentoring, we've certainly seen the payoffs in terms of corporate leaders in our community providing bus money, and then we're able to bus kids from vulnerable neighborhoods in our communities, and this is happening across the province, not just here in Edmonton. And then people are able to be mentored at the workplace by citizens who care deeply about our community being the best that it can be. And there are a number of things that that does. Lots of people who work in the downtown core use public transportation. So they don't have a car to be able to drive to some school that might be 8 blocks away. Lots of people who do drive to the city core to go to work, being able to get their car out of their parking lots and then back into their parking lots has an additional cost. If your lunch break is 45 minutes or an hour and your employer is saying, hey, we'll backfill you, if you're traveling a long distance, that's really difficult to do. So when I look at the corporate mentoring model, what I see is good people that are in a site that we can bring kids to interact, to learn from each other, and then be able to get kids back to the school site. So I think it's got some great potential. I also think that we're very blessed here in Alberta, where we have the credits for taking mentoring courses. And if I was to dream out, and if I was to think about 25 years from now, if I could imagine that thousands of young people would have taken that course, they would have learned about being a mentor. They wouldn't even need a formal organization to be part of. It would change how they view other people. It would change how they interact with other people. So I actually think it's our number one gift, is that if we can up the number of young people participating through the credit courses in high school, and thus they become knowledge about mentoring, they can immediately put that to play right in their own school and in their own neighborhood. And then the other two examples that I talked about in terms of teen mentors and corporate mentors tend to be much more formal types of programs. But I think those are probably the three places that if I had to put a bet, I'd be putting them on those three ideas.
When you shared that, it made me think about instead of us as a mentoring agency saying, come to our office between these hours and these hours to do the mentoring, we're actually coming to the volunteers and saying, how can we enhance your user experience, whether that's it's right. Think about cutting down our transportation and anything else. So another way we often get asked about in innovative programs is around this question of virtual mentoring or digital mentoring. In your travels and experiences, if you had to look out, where do you think we're going to see the will we see FaceTime mentoring in future? What do you think will be the new moves here?
Yeah, another great question. You know, about 1998, I read a report about the fact that there were 7 million young people involved in mentoring relationships around the world with educational institutions. My own son that year was 10 years old, and he was being mentored by a professor at Harvard in a particular area of science that he was interested in. And it was all done virtually. And I think about the work that Big Brothers Big Sisters in Texas has been doing. I think maybe they're in about their 10th year. It's called Mentoring 2.0. It's an all online mentoring program with a real focus to try to help young people who are struggling in school. So I think what's important about what I've seen so far about digital mentoring is that it tends to have a focus around a particular outcome you're trying to achieve, time limited. And I think that it's already growing. I think that we as organizations have perhaps not had the same kind of relationship with the digital because we're actually into the business of building human relationships. And one of the things that I often hear people say is that what's missing is the ability for people to come together. But I do think that the whole digital technology environment will grow. Think about the amount of counseling that is now being done online. Think about the number of surgeries that are now being done online. So I think we'll find our way. I think what would be wonderful is if a tech company in our country was to step up and say, hey, let's walk beside you and figure out a way to do this work. I know of a mentoring program that's running at the University of Cape Breton with Indigenous students in the business program there. And the immense success that digital support from elders has had on those young people and the way they've been able to pull together programming that has a front-end piece where you physically meet and then a year of digital mentoring and then a back end at the end of, again, physically being together to celebrate. So I think there are lots of models that we'll build out. And I look all the time across the border with what Texas Big Brothers Big Sisters is doing because it's the closest to me that I get to see, and that's what that looks like. And so, I think it'll have a place in a space going forth.
In terms of greater connectivity, we're also seeing greater complexity in terms of the kids that we serve. We hear from our partners that more and more agencies are reporting more kids in poverty, more adverse childhood experiences, more challenges, more mental health issues are coming up. And of course, we're much more culturally diverse than maybe a homogenous Alberta of 50 years ago or so. So when you think about going ahead to address complexity, how is this impacting the training, the recruitment, the program design, and how do you as a big agency respond?
Well, I think that there's a lot more intentionality today around what structure, system, processes look like. Things like training or making your application and helping to screen people into the organization. But we've also come and are coming through a time when we know more. We know more than we've ever known in social services. We have more labels and more language for anything than we've ever known in this field of work. And because of that, we talk about it quite differently now. We used to talk about the kindness of strangers, and now we talk about the screened, supported, trained volunteer. And it's interesting if you kind of go back in history and look at who were those kind strangers serving 100 years ago. Many of the kids were serving today. But we know more about where our kids are. Our school systems are very much in tune with the needs of kids. We have more tools in our toolkit. We have more organizations. If you look at the not-for-profit sector in Alberta, I believe we have been growing for the last 30 years at a rate of about 10-12% a year. And of course, so much of this work is now delivered by not-for-profit charitable organizations and schools across the province and across the country. And so I think that, yes, we are certainly seeing more kids than we saw 40 years ago being identified. But I can also say that we have better systems today, we have better knowledge today, and we have a better appreciation about if we don't do the heavy lifting around this work, there's a price to pay and what that price looks like. So I actually think we're in a good place. You get a little down because the waiting lists are larger, but the reality is that moms and dads, and I'm so proud of them because they know what their kids need. They're stepping up. 60% of our referrals now come from moms and dads. That is exactly the way you want society to build itself out. You want moms and dads and grandmas and grandpas and aunts and uncles to be able to say, hey, you know, we care about our child and they could use some extra support, or we could use some extra support as family. I think that's the great gift about what's going on, is families have become informed. Schools have become a network around them. Community organizations are there for them to reach out to. And good citizens have stepped up as corporations, as governments, as private family foundations, as United Ways, as municipalities, to provide the resources because they want their kids in their community to do well.
I was last week, I was helping another partner in the Edmonton area called The Green Room, who I know you know, starting a mentoring program through the Islamic community. And I asked them, what has been their journey so far? And they were very deferential about all the, and thankful for all the experience that Biggs Edmonton had shared with them. And I think another move is, it seems that more and more agencies, instead of being proprietary about their knowledge or guarded about their kids, their budget, their silo, are actually trying to say, you know what, you're better suited to serve these kids. We want to help you get a program started. Is that your experience as well?
Absolutely, and without question. It. I guess, Michael, some of us might say it is very much like who we are as people in this community. Edmonton is really well known for being a little different. And we've had people say to us across this country for a very long time, you work together. You actually, if another agency's got a financial problem, you might actually try to help them find some dollars to support that. It really does speak to the pioneer spirit in this city and in this province. And I think that the best way we can ensure that kids and families have what they need is that we do it together. Community's already paid for it once, so we don't own it. Somebody invested in us, so we have a responsibility to actually pass it on. We'd be failing our community if we didn't pass on our knowledge. I think the other thing is that people in our community are really comfortable on knocking on each other's door and saying, I don't know. Can you help me? No. And that's real. People really want to do their very, very best, and they want to do it together. And so thank you for asking me about that, because I just think it's one of the DNAs of this community, and one that that we should all be very, very proud of.
So whenever I try and, or I've seen others try and give you a compliment, and you always stand at the mic and you just defer to your any kind of praise or recognition whatsoever. You always say, oh, it's my board, it's my staff, it's my team. It's very hard to give you a compliment without you sharing it with everyone else around you. So let's talk a little bit about that, about the team that you've built with everyone around you. How did you build shared purpose, cohesion among your board and staff team? And for the new green behind the ears executive directors listening, what advice would you have for them?
Yeah, you know, great question. I was brought up with this belief. Think about what you can get done if no one has to have the credit. I remember my family saying that to me. I was 6, 7, 8 years old. And if you were to talk to my son, Braden would say to you that that was part of his upbringing as well. You know, I am blessed to have a career. When I started out, I didn't know this would be a career. It was, you know, a job along the way. I had moved here and a position was open, and I felt I was qualified. I applied for it. I was young, just as so many of our staff who work with us are young. I believe that if I made a contribution, I could help change the world. It's one of the things that's still alive in our staff and our organization, and we see new staff all the time, and it's so wonderful to hear them with that basic belief that they want to do their very, very best to make the world a better place. But when you have the privilege of volunteers coming together and staff coming together and supporters and donors coming together, and everybody's got something they believe in collectively, you can't go wrong. It would be impossible to fail. And that's what happened for our organization. Good citizens wanted to play a role, asked how they could help, got involved as volunteers, and have been here a long time. And so we've been very blessed. I think one of the big challenges in the not-for-profit sector is often because of the busyness of people's lives, they become a board member, for example, for 1 or 2 years. that's so hard on an organization. And we've been able to have board members for 8, 10, 12 years. And have new people always coming through, but that group of very, very dedicated people who make sure that they mentor the next generation of board member, when you get that kind of longevity, you get history, you get knowledge, you get commitment, you get a voice, and people then are able to use that on behalf and for our kids. And then when you are able to mobilize citizens to step up and become Big Brother volunteers or mentors or corporate mentors or teen mentors, they keep you accountable as to why they're in the organization, and that's good for us all in terms of, you know, why are there 800 kids waiting? And then you have to stay on top of that, and you have to be able to every day do the very best you can to remove barriers, get things done so that kids can be served. Thus, our work at AMP, as I said earlier, because what AMP did was gave us that ability to take issues we couldn't solve alone and now begin to look at them collectively from a provincial base, which is why I think Alberta is doing as well as it is. If you think about communities like Edmonton and Calgary, we're big organizations in the mentoring field. The Edmonton Agency has more active mentors than any other organization in Canada. And if you put Edmonton and Calgary together, we would be bigger than most of the jurisdictions in British Columbia and Ontario. Now, I'm not bragging that, you know, Alberta's got it all figured out. But the fact of the matter is, because our DNA is about working together, and so you see that with the work with AMP, you see that with the work with education, you see that with community organizations turning to each other, and you see that with citizens stepping up. And I get to see that every day with staff and volunteers and board members and committee members who really want to be part of the team and want to make it happen. So if I've done anything, I have been able to convince some folks that this would be a good place to invest their time and their money, and that some good results could happen here. And then a great large group of folks. And I would say to you that we probably have involved in this organization about 10,000-12,000 people. And that became our mobilization, our movement of people who care about this community and want kids to do well.
I heard that to be on the board of Bigs Edmonton, you actually have to serve for a year first as like a board. What do you call it?
A guest of the board.
Guest of the board. So you have to show commitment for the full calendar year before you're a board member. And I heard that you do not cut corners on this. Even the wife of the mayor wanted to serve on your board, and she still was required to do the year
she
as
was,
a guest.
Yes.
Is that true?
It is true. It's true. Yes, Sarah joined us. What a wonderful volunteer. Sarah's not only been a guest of the board, but she's also been a big sister for a long time and co-chaired our Lobster Lovers event, which is a major fundraising event for the organization. She has run girls groups for us. She has given speech after speech after speech to corporations. And so thanks for allowing me just to say thank you, Sarah. But yes, the board put the practice in place many years ago. And it's an opportunity for board members, for people who want to become board members, to really touch and feel the organization so that they're able to say a year into it that, yeah, no, this is where I want to be, or this isn't what I quite thought was going on. And that's important for folks because you heard me say we have board members that have been with us 8, 10, 12 years. And so people don't come in here for a short time. People come for a long time, and their roles might change. I have a board member who retired from our board after serving 12 years and had moved away and recently moved back. And she connected with me the other day, and she said, "Do you know what this person's doing and this person's doing and this person's doing?" And I said, "Oh, no, she's not on the board anymore, but she's become a major donor, and here's where you can find her." "Nope, she's not on the board anymore, but she's now on the governance committee." "Nope, she's not on the board anymore, but she's on the golf committee." So I can tell you that people will say, when you come in the door, there's no back way out. And I think that's exactly what you want to build, is a place in a space that citizens feel they own. It's theirs. They can help shape it, and they can contribute.
Another one of your successes, I think I was trying to count, I think you've served over a dozen premiers in Alberta and you're known as one of the few people in the community who can access any mayor or any premier with a knock on the door. So over your career, over 40 years, what have you learned about good government relations and what would you advise our listeners?
Honesty is still the best policy, no matter what the consequences be. I've never, ever done work with our municipal or provincial or federal government in a way that would ever embarrass people. I've always tried to go to folks to ask them if the consequence of something related to policy or a program, if that was actually the way they had hoped things would turn out. And what I've learned over the years is that majority of people get up every day and they want to do their very, very best. And sometimes there are unintended consequences of choices that we make. And I have had many, many years, Michael, where I have been able to go chat with government colleagues about the fact that, you know, things didn't go quite the way one planned. And I've never met anybody to this day who didn't say, let me see what I can do about that, and genuinely mean that. And so... You know, I know our agency has a reputation, and whether I'm here or not, that reputation will hold. And that is kids first, politics second. So we've never, ever, ever as an organization become involved in politics. While we've probably had a few meetings with politicians over the years, quite frankly, not many. We've done our work with deputy ministers, with assistant deputy ministers, with civil servants, people that they themselves are in a role to serve the people. We're in a role to serve the people, and it's collectively that we can do better. So we've really not become involved politically as an organization. That's not our role. And I can say this to you. I've had, you know, assistant staff at the Alberta government as an example who started as, you know, a frontline social worker and became the minister of the department. So we have that longevity. And so, you know, when people are serving for those long terms, and many of our deputy ministers have been in government 30, 35 years. So it's not like there are new people all the time. Our governments may change in terms of the political structure, but our civil servants have not. And we have been able to work very, very closely because they care just as much as we care about doing their very, very best in the community. And sometimes, again, we make choices and they make choices and things didn't turn out the way you planned. But if you can have an honest conversation about that, most times you can find a new way, a new path to get things done.
Similar question, but a different subject in terms of building trust with funders or granting bodies or foundations. What has been your experience?
Well, our staff have done that. When our staff make a commitment to our funders, because as you can imagine, there are far more organizations than there are dollars, and there are far more organizations doing exceptionally good work in this community than there are the number of resources to support that. So we have to make sure then that what we promise, we deliver. But there are times when we design a program and we think if we turn, you know, right, we're going to get such an outcome. And we get down a path 6 months in and we go, we're not going to get here from here. And what we've learned is stop then. Go back to the funder. Sit down and have a conversation about the fact that what we thought we knew and what we've now learned we know are two different things. And what we've learned is that if we always think of our donor and our funder as our partner, then that means we always tell them the truth. And when we tell them the truth, they will always help us find another path. And I know that for lots of folks, you get scared about the fact that what if my funding gets pulled? But you had said to me earlier, you know, if we're talking to a young audience of executive directors, what I can assure them is funding never gets pulled when we're honest about the realities that we're living. Because the path we're trying to take may not be the one that gets us there, but the funder still wants to invest in us finding that path. So always think of your funder as a partner, and that means they get the good stories as well as the bad stories.
So when we're talking about communicating results and communicating the success of a mentoring program, what have you found in terms of storytelling is most effective? Infographics, videos, annual reports, not just the tactics themselves, but in terms of a strategy, because we do important work. And often I think we in the mentoring movement don't take the time to actually celebrate that and to actually make others aware of how important this is. So how would you, what in your experience in over 40 years, what are some of the ways you've communicated the things you're most proud of?
You know, the young people who have grown up with a mentor are our best storyteller. They're our best infographic. They're our best report. We will all have to always write reports and narratives and prove our worth through evaluation. That has just become part of the not-for-profit sector. But when we don't take time to have people who have grown up, and the difference now has come in their lives, and they can recognize where it came from, they're our greatest storyteller. They're our greatest champion to talk about mentoring. But I do think it's important that we all stay very focused on making sure that the programs we're running are actually delivering outcomes. And that's hard to do, because you don't get an outcome because you had a mentor for 3 months. You get an outcome because you've had somebody who cares about you in your life for a number of years. And there aren't easy systems to follow people. And there aren't easy processes in order to be able to find a young person, you know, 10 years out in terms of if you reflect back. And so we're all trying to do work in a way that allows us to be able to demonstrate to our funders that this is a good place to invest, that you'll get good outcomes here for kids. But it is a multifaceted, right? We've got to do the narratives, we've got to do the evaluation, we've got to do the research, and we've got to have our young people tell their story.
And then finally, as executive director, we can't pass an opportunity to talk about fundraising and program sustainability. Would you be willing to share something you've either started or stopped doing in the fundraising area over the years? I'm sure there was an event or something that you've decided to stop doing. I'm sure there's other things that you've decided to double down on.
Yeah, no, Michael, right on both points. There are still many agencies in the country, and good for them, that run Bull for Kids' Sake. But we got into the market in 1981 and out of the market in 1994. Because when we looked at the cost of running the campaign versus the amount of money that was coming in, and I mean real costs, real staff time, and volunteer time that was put into the project, the return on investment wasn't there. However, having said that, we got into doing our dream homes in 1986, and the first year we made $60,000, and last year we made $900,000. And so it is... you know, you have to sort through what do you stay with in the market and what do you leave in the market. But I also say this to you, sometimes things aren't as clear as just money. And so I'll give you an example. We do our Lobster Lovers event. It raises about $150,000 a year in profit for the agency. But it's more than that. It also recruits volunteers for us. It also recruits individual donors for us. It also recruits corporate donors for us. It also has people join our board of directors. It also has people who sit on foundation boards and United Way boards and are elected officials. And so that one campaign, if you looked at it just in terms of money, you would say that's a fair return, but it's much bigger than that because citizens of our community come together and then use their networks. And so maybe that event has 450 people in it, but the networks that they can bring to us are probably 10,000 people. And so you really have to look at projects, not just for what's the dollar value on return, but what are all the other assets that it brings to you.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. If there's a program that you're aware of, or if there's a mentoring leader in your community that you would like us to profile on the Mentoring Minute podcast, please send us an email at mentor.support@albertamentors.ca. Have a great week.